This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hi, I'm Joel Hilliker. I'm coming to you live this morning from our studio in Edmond. I have a guest with me in the studio to talk about some momentous events taking place in the Middle East. Brent Noctegal is usually stationed in Jerusalem, but he's visiting here in Edmond for a couple of weeks, so we thought we'd take advantage of that. First, we're going to talk about the election yesterday in Israel. Quite an interesting result that leaves a lot in doubt. We'll bring you up to speed on the latest news and what it may mean for Israel going forward. We'll also talk with Brent about the major attack that took place this past Saturday on Saudi oil infrastructure, a plant considered the world's most important oil processing plant. It cut Saudi Arabia's oil output in half. Oil prices immediately skyrocketed. There's a lot of evidence that Iran was behind the attack. This would represent a major act of war on Iran's part. So we have a lot to talk about there. In our third segment today, we're going to talk about the longtime dictator of Zimbabwe. Earlier this month, Robert Mugabe died. There are plenty of lessons we can take from his rule. We're going to hear a report from trumpet writer Anthony Chibadirwe, a native of Zimbabwe who grew up under Mugabe. And I'll conclude the program by sharing a potent key for your personal growth. So let's get straight to the Israeli elections. We have our Jerusalem correspondent, Brent Noctegal, here in the studio. Hello, Brent.
Hi.
Appreciate you coming in. When we looking at the headlines now, it still looks uncertain exactly what this is going to end up leaving Israel with as far as a government goes. Maybe you could just bring up to speed with what we know now.
Yeah, Israeli elections are notorious for murky results. After the vote takes place, there's normally a period in which the leading vote getter representing the party that won the most seats in the election would have the opportunity to try and form a government, to cobble together a coalition. Very rarely does one party have a majority in the Knesset to then determine who's going to be the prime minister and such straight off the bat. And this is exactly what's happened again with this election. People will remember that 5 months ago we had an Israeli election, and it turned out that no one could bring together a government, bringing together different sides or different political parties and making that 61 member majority for the Knesset. Netanyahu tried, and also the other side tried also, the second leading vote getter at that point was, or about the same, but I guess Likud, Netanyahu's party, and the second party, Blue and White, led by former General Benny Gantz, they both received the same amount of votes. And so they had the opportunity to bring together different factions, and Israel's full of them. You've got the religious parties, you've got the secular parties, you've got the parties on the right, the parties on the left. And so to bring together enough of those underneath the leadership of one man is very difficult to do, and it proved impossible back five months ago. And so Israel went to elections a second time, and that was yesterday. And it turns out that it looks like Blue and White and Likud received very much or close to the same amount of votes that they received last time. And so there is going to be a period of wheeling and dealing that takes place now. For the next, it could be quick if there are parties that come together and agree to be under the leadership of a certain individual. Now, at this point, it looks like the individual that's going to be tasked by the president, Reuven Rivlin, to have the first crack at producing a coalition government is not going to be Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Mm. Benny Gantz, who I think right now he's got 33 seats and Likud has 32, at least with 90% of the vote counted. He has the greatest opportunity to put a government together, it seems. And so he is probably going to get the first opportunity to do so by the president.
Tell us about Benny Gantz and what he represents and what this tells us about Israelis, what they're voting for, choosing him over Netanyahu.
Right. It is a little bit difficult now to just cast it as Mr. Netanyahu is Mr. Security. He talks about him as that. And the Israelis do feel safe with him. In terms of protecting them from threats, he's done so well for so long, be it the Second Intifada, or the building of the wall and things like that that really took off underneath his reign. that stopped these terrorist attacks from happening, and even facing up to a threat against Iran. Israel hasn't faced a serious war in Netanyahu's tenure against Hezbollah. He's kept them at bay with sufficient strikes. And so he's seen as Mr. Security, but unfortunately he's got a challenger in Benny Gantz that is often seen as even further on, even more hawkish in terms of protecting Israel from Iran and such. He's very aware of the threats as well. So you've got a military man, and not just him, the other couple leaders inside that party are also ex-military generals. And so Israel is not necessarily facing a choice of one leader that's soft on security and the other that's hard on security. Both of them are hard on security. And so that has then allowed other people that do worry for their safety to have a little bit of wriggle room in voting for somebody that isn't Netanyahu. And so you've got that factor. You also have a factor where there is a large percentage of the population in Israel that are tired of Mr. Netanyahu's rule. After 10 years in power, he's become the longest-serving prime minister in Israel's history. And so Israel is notorious for throwing out its leaders before Netanyahu came along. This, you know, you remember Olmert, Tzipi Livni, Barak, Netanyahu before. There was just like every 2 years, it's like Israel barely gets to an election before the leader has been thrown out. And yet we've had this period that's very strange for 10 years with his rule. And so there are some that just want to get rid of him. And so I would say there's half the electorate that are like, I'm just not voting for Likud. I'm voting for other parties in the hopes that he is removed from power. And it looks like at this point, barring some type of compromise, that maybe one of the kingmakers outside of those two parties, Likud and Blue and White, if they make some compromises with Netanyahu or Blue and White, there may be a way for one of them to become prime minister. But both of them don't have an easy task of getting to that point.
Well, it is interesting that Benny Gantz represents this more hawkish position, that Israel definitely recognizes just how dangerous these times are, and it's possible that he would even take the nation further in the direction of defending itself against regional threats. I'd like to just talk a little bit about the corruption charges against Netanyahu. How much, you know, I'm kind of interested in your view on how strong the case is against him, and how much that's factoring into people kind of getting a weary of a Netanyahu government.
Yeah, there's three cases that are being brought forward, and I think some of them are going to get some time, some airtime in early October regarding whether he is guilty or not. There will be some type of hearing.
And if I understand it correctly, he would have been protected against some of that had he gotten a larger majority.
Well, he tried to push through an immunity bill that would not allow a sitting prime minister to be prosecuted while he is in power. That failed to pass. He would have liked to have gotten that, but Israelis, and justifiably so, I would say, they determined that was the wrong way to go about it. It is left to be seen just how much Israelis care about these charges. Some of them are, I would say, I mean, I think he probably did possibly break the law in some of these instances. But the instances are very soft, and the fact that somebody is willing, dealing with a little bit with the media, trying to get some media favors to get some supportive coverage, or accepting some gifts that don't really amount to much. Yes, technically you're not meant to receive gifts from foreign dignitaries, but if you accept a few cigars from one of your friends who also is a foreign dignitary, I mean, Israelis could understand that. And so while technically I think he did break the law in some ways, I don't think that they have that much weight in terms of the middle of the country, if we can use that American term. They don't really care as much because they see all politicians in Israel susceptible to such things. And so this vote in itself isn't a vote against his because of the corruption charges, I don't think, at all. Maybe 20% or something are voting against that.
Yeah. So we are going to be talking about Iran in the second segment, and we've been watching in recent months just how much bolder Iran has gotten in its attacks against Israel. What are your thoughts on how much, if we're in the middle of this kind of turmoil and wheeling and dealing, you said it could happen quickly, it might not happen quickly, it could be kind of messy. How much does that or might that impact Israel's ability to respond to
Right. It does put Israel in a very tight position, especially if the United States intends to use Israel in some type of alliance in an attack against Iran over the next weeks or so. That could happen. And you have Israel that I'm not sure how the Israeli law works to the point that the prime minister could maybe nullify part of these elections or at least delay the effect of them if Israel is at war. Nobody's talking about that, so I don't want to come out and say much about that. But that could be something that happens going forward. And as I said, both of them are kind of strong on Iran, so it might not have a huge factor in terms of what Israel would favor. I mean, right now you do have Avigdor Lieberman. He's he's the head of Yisrael Bitenu. This is the party that was the fourth biggest vote getter. Mm-hmm. They got 9 seats or something like that. And basically you have this option where he is the kingmaker. If he decides to go with Netanyahu, then Netanyahu could be the prime minister. If he decides to go with Benny Gantz, Benny Gantz could be the prime minister. That's only if Benny Gantz accepts the Arab parties into his coalition, which would be phenomenal and hasn't happened before in the sense of that might be dangerous as well.
But it was Lieberman who sparked this.
Right.
Whole...
He was so stubborn before that he would not go into and is in a coalition with Netanyahu previously, even though he had done before, because over the other parts of the coalition, the ultra-Orthodox that have got different rules that apply to them in terms of the mandatory military service and things like that. And he was against that so sternly that he decided that I can't go with Netanyahu and I'm going to, you know, jump ship and we're going to go to elections again. Now, nobody has the appetite to go to a third election. Really, what we're seeing right now is almost the same as what happened the last time. And so technically, we could go to a third election in, you know, a few months. He has said... Lieberman said he does not want that and he will compromise and not allow that to happen. And so what they're calling for now is what's called a unity government. Yeah. This hasn't happened since the early 80s. And this is where the leading parties just come together. And so Benny Gantz's party and Likud, Netanyahu's party, would come together and they would form majority themselves. It's like the leader of the opposition coming together with the main party and they forming a government. Now, to do that, they have said, Benny Gantz has said, that he's going to be the prime minister. They're not going to allow Netanyahu to be the prime minister in that. So I can't see them going for that, prime minister going for that. Now, the other big question is whether Likud, the party itself, has had enough of Netanyahu. Mm. And that could be a way forward. They could ditch their leader and then become part of the government because that's one of the conditions, it seems, of Benny Gantz. Mm-hmm. I don't see that happening because Netanyahu's the face of Likud for so long and there's no leader underneath him that's going to have the charisma. Or just the proven success to be the head of that party. So I don't think they're going to do that. I personally think it's too early to count out the way that Netanyahu does wheel and deal in these situations. I think it's too early to deny the effect that some drastic political and security events could have over the next few weeks at pushing Israel to accept Netanyahu as their leader. I mean, that's happened before. If you go back to the Six-Day War, you had basically Levi Eshkol, who hadn't really had that much experience in it, step down and allowed another leader to come in and take the reins of the country because he had a proven track record and he inspired confidence in the Israeli people that they were going to find a way out of this situation. And so right now it looks bad for Netanyahu, but other events could take the forefront even in this period. Over the next 6 weeks or so to determine whether he actually does retain power.
Well, we'll definitely have to continue to watch that situation could lead any number of directions, and then viewing that in light of what we expect in terms of biblical prophecy for Israel, it will be very interesting to see what happens. There's more to be decided here, so we'll be staying tuned. Keep your eye on thetrumpet.com for that. We've been talking to Brent Nachtigall about yesterday's election in Israel. And while I'm at it, I'd like to draw your attention to the fact that Brent has his own weekly radio program on Trumpet Radio called Watch Jerusalem. It's part of thetrumpet.com's sister website, watchjerusalem.co.il. And this brings you news and interviews about events in the Holy City in the Middle East from on location, looking at those events from a biblical perspective. Brent gives you the most important developments happening on the ground and what's being uncovered from beneath the ground as well. He talks quite a bit about archaeology and the Bible, archaeological evidence, old and new, that shows biblical history. You can find his program at thetrumpet.com under the Listen tab at Watch Jerusalem. We will take a short break, and when we return, we'll talk to Brent about the dramatic attack this past weekend on Saudi Arabia, the world's most important oil processing plant. Stick around.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
It has been called Saudi Arabia's Pearl Harbor. A terrorist attack this past Saturday crippled an oil plant in Saudi Arabia, considered the world's most important oil processing plant. It cut the nation's oil output in half. This represents 5% of the world's oil production, a massive blow. Oil prices immediately skyrocketed. There was a lot of evidence that Iran was behind the attack. This would represent a major act of war on the part of the most aggressive nation in the region. But Iran has denied direct involvement. So we've kept Brent Nachtigall here with us to talk about this. He wrote about it in Monday's Trumpet Brief. So, Brent, first, if you could just describe the attack and the scope of how serious it was.
It was extremely serious, something we haven't seen for a long, long time. We had these strikes that targeted this oil facility, or two oil facilities in Saudi Arabia, on the eastern part of Saudi Arabia, where the main oil fields are. And they're refinery and plants that held the oil, so not the pumps or the wells or anything like that. But as you said, there was, because of these attacks, they were led by drones, armed drones, and also precision-guided missiles as well. Both of those were both those means were employed in the attack. And I think there were about 19 strikes, that were 19 attempts, and 17 of those actually hit their targets. And this, as you said, brought the oil production facility to be offline for a number of days. It is coming back online faster than expected. But we did see one of these shocks to the oil supply chain that we haven't seen since the Kuwait war, basically. 1981 is when, I think 1981, is when the last time we saw oil jump by 20% over such a short period. And again, 5 to 6% of the world's oil came offline. It's going to be 3 weeks before all of that oil comes back online, so it's going to take that long to repair. Although Saudi Arabia has done steps to increase its production or increase the ability to get oil to the public. Now, it turns out that the initial group that claimed responsibility for these attacks were the Houthis. They are the Iranian-backed proxy down in Yemen that's fighting against Saudi Arabia down there as well. We have seen numerous attacks by them using drones, using different missiles as well, attacking Saudi Arabia. And Iran came and said it was the Houthis. The Houthis said it was the Houthis. And yet the United States came out and said, no, it wasn't the Houthis right off the bat. And others have said, other governments don't believe it was the Houthis as well, that they probably don't possess this ability to fly precision-guided munitions over such a large distance. It's over, I think, 900 or 700 miles from Yemeni territory. So that's quite far. And so the U.S. has basically been putting out more and more information over the last couple of days that show that this attack came from the north specifically. If you look at where all the impacts of these missiles or drones came from, they were all targeting the northwestern side of these plants, northern northwestern side of these plants. And so it looks like the U.S. has said, basically, some Pentagon officials said overnight that these attacks were launched from Iran's mainland. The U.S. has come, that's their stated position now, and that they flew over parts of southern Iraq, just around the northern part where the Persian Gulf, where Iraq meets the Persian Gulf, and then down towards Saudi Arabia, traveling about 300 to 500 kilometers. And then hitting these targets, which again represents the most serious escalation of Iran fighting against Saudi Arabia or Israel, really, or any type of adversary in the region in a long time. And so right now we wait and see what the response is going to be.
So, but Iran is basically denying it and sort of giving itself cover in that sense. We see this a lot where actors, we've seen this with Russia a lot of times, it'll do something and just sort of shrug its shoulders and pretend like it wasn't really involved. That seems to be the position that Iran is taking here. But really, if you put this into a larger context, we see this pattern of Iran getting bolder and bolder in the way that it is attacking very significant targets. It's going after Israel. Here it's going after Saudi Arabia. Maybe you could just tell us what sort of incentive Iran would have for undertaking an attack like
this. Yeah, so Iran is facing now this a massive onslaught from the United States in terms of financial onslaught with the sanctions. This is affecting the Iranian economy to a great degree, and it's affected mostly their oil output, their ability to sell oil on the market, which I think it's over half of their annual income at the Iranian nation comes through oil products. And so if they've basically said, if we can't sell our oil, we're going to limit other people's ability to sell it also. And so we've had Iran basically attacking in a very interesting way. They didn't come out with this attack first. No, we've seen them attack, have those mine attacks on different Saudi vessels and Emirati vessels going back a couple of months now just outside the Strait of Hormuz. We had them impounding a British vessel that carried oil. They still have that right now. So with their fast attack boats, in the Persian Gulf have been impacting ships daily. To this day, they're still trying to get ships to be pulled over, but you've got the American and British military presence there that's kind of stopping that. We don't hear about that because they haven't been successful, but they're trying to do that. And then we had, you know, the taking out of the U.S. drone, this multi-million dollar drone, blew it up out of the sky, and there was no response with that. And so we are seeing this escalating series of attempts by Iran to up the ante for the United States to draw down on their financial sanctions. That is their goal. In the short term, it is for the United States to back off, maybe come towards another negotiation, even though Iran says they don't want a negotiation. They do with the United States. They want to get some breathing room for their economy. And what we're seeing is this increasing ability of Iran or desire of Iran to force America's hand to do something. And they're banking that America doesn't want to do any type of strong military action against Iran. Mm-hmm. And so we'll see. I mean, you have to go back and you have to recognize that the U.S. said it was going to be open towards some negotiation at some point as well, even recently. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting also, you saw the firing of Bolton the other week.
Right.
And this attack comes out after that. And Bolton, we had an article today by Clifford May, the head of the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, coming out and saying, even though Bolton's not there, you'd hope that somebody like Bolton is whispering in President Trump's ear and saying that appeasement is not going to work. President Trump believes that the financial sanctions and stronger financial sanctions are going to turn Iran around. To this point, we haven't seen that.
I definitely want to return to America's response to this, but just to follow up on the point about Iran basically using attacks against oil infrastructure as a weapon, this is something that the Trumpet's editor-in-chief, Gerald Fleury, has been talking about for years, that this would be part of a push prophesied in Daniel 11, disrupting oil flow. This really fits that pattern.
Oh, yeah, exactly. I mean, if Iran is going to have the ability to impact the world, this is what they're going to have to hit. They're going to have to hit oil infrastructure. They're going to have to close down oil choke points, such as the Strait of Hormuz and the Bab el-Mandeb on the other side of the Persian Gulf, other side of the Arabian Peninsula. We've talked about that at length, and Mr. Fleury has really hit that for decades now, saying that that is going to be the strategy of Iran. As the biblically prophesied king of the south that is going to control large portions of the Middle East, they are going to have a strategy having the ability to stop or severely hamper oil flow out of the Middle East towards Europe and other places. And this is what we're seeing. We're not just seeing them decide, they're not just about taking over land or great swaths of land or increasing their power and that way taking over nations for its sake in itself. Iran has greater goals than that. And we're seeing it impact the whole world through this. Oil prices went up everywhere. I think Iran might be surprised at how quickly oil prices came back down, which indicates to them that they're going to have to do a lot more, even, I think, for a long-term break or a long-term stoppage or increase in price for the oil price, because it has come back down even over the last couple of days. I think it's only about 5 or 6% up from where it was before this attack. So it's still up, but it is coming back down. Saudi Arabia's ability to keep on getting oil to the market. The U.S. is overstocked with oil right now. And so world conditions, it's interesting. If oil was already at a higher price, you would see greater motivation from Saudi Arabia, from the United States, to act definitively and offensively right now. But it's like the pressure is building, and Iran is going to have to act in an even more robust way to try and have the impact that it could have had under worse oil conditions, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that's an interesting perspective on this. I'd like to just read a quote from your trumpet brief on Monday. And this is still kind of in light of there not being necessarily definitive proof the way that it's being presented that it was Iran involved. But you write here, if the attack came from Iran's mainland, Saudi Arabia and potentially the United States would have little choice but to attack the Iranian homeland, lest it appear weak. And in the Middle East, appearing weak only emboldens your adversaries. So we did have, immediately after the attack, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said this was definitely Iran. President Trump, he maybe left the door open a little bit more, but he said the United States is locked and loaded for an attack if we verify that it was Iran. What might we expect? I guess it sounds like what you're saying is that there may be enough steam to allow out that we wouldn't necessarily have to go after them just because the price of oil isn't going through the roof right now.
Yeah, I think that there is the ability to, even as crazy as it sounds, that somebody could attack the homeland. I think everyone now believes it did come from Iran as well. I mean, the evidence the United States is going to produce on this, they're going to make it extremely public. They want the whole world to know it came from Iran, so they will do that. That's all there. And yet, since the oil price has come back down, nothing has really happened. Maybe there is a way to climb down this situation. Now, a lot of people that have studied the Middle East would be upset by that. They understand that, as I wrote, this will only embolden Iran earlier. Even just before we came live, President Trump tweeted that he's going to increase sanctions substantially on Iran. And Iran's probably laughing at this. And Israel's probably in the sense that Iran is going to have to take another attack, and that the U.S. is so weak that they would not have another attack. Now, you could say that Iran wants the sanctions gone, and they do. And you could say that this is Mr. Trump's attempt to say it doesn't matter what you do, we're still going to have sanctions on you as well. And so there could be a broader strategy to this than what's clear. But what we've seen from the past is that only strong military action is going to deter Iran. Now, what does Saudi Arabia do? Do they just sit by and allow Iran to attack their homeland in a way that we haven't seen before, attack their oil infrastructure? Saudi Arabia is losing a lot of money right now because of this Iranian attack. And so do they sit on their hands and do nothing? Now, we don't know what the response is going to be, but it might be now, even if, as I wrote that, that Iran will take another shot at something even bigger. If the sanctions don't come down, don't expect Iran to just sit back and not attack something else more definitively even than this.
Well, you'd have to think that Germany would be watching all of this very closely, and that you could see a scenario where this actually increases their backing for the Saudi regime in trying to defend them against attacks such as this, being as dependent on oil as they are. But Bible prophecy is definitely clear that the United States is not going to defeat Iran.
Right. Yeah, we expect Europe to get more fully involved, and they're already increasing some help for Saudi Arabia right now. I think the world was kind of surprised at the ability that Iran had to make this strike. I mean, this was a precision strike. This was a strike that hit exactly what Iran had wanted to hit from over a couple hundred miles away. If they can, and evaded, or the missile defense system of the United States was not able to detect this. These are drones that are flying very low over the ground that basically were given a free pass from the American defense system. You've got American bases all through this area. And so if Iran can attack exactly what it wanted, why couldn't have it attacked an American base as well? And so there are very big causes for concern going forward. And that's another reason why we might not have seen a retaliation attack as yet. Because Israel, they could expect some violence from this as well. The United States and Saudi Arabia are basically plugging the holes right now, thinking, where is everywhere that Iran could attack if we attack them? And that's taking some time because America has so many targets that Iran can hit over the Middle East. There's been a drawdown in forces, and so you have America being quite vulnerable. Mm. And as much as that sounds like that's crazy business, they are quite vulnerable in the Middle East. And we do expect eventually Europe to take notice of what Iran is doing, remembering that they are on the receiving end of a lot of this oil that comes out of the Persian Gulf. They need it. They need that to function and to survive. And so eventually they've got to see that Iran doesn't, by Iran having this policy of shutting down oil arteries, of trying to take out the oil supply, that this is going to affect them. And eventually they are going to have to act.
Well, we do appreciate your insights, Brent. We've been talking to trumpet writer Brent Noctegal about this attack on Saudi Arabia's oil infrastructure. If you want to read more about it, you can check out our article. It was published on Monday by Warren Reich. The title of that, Iran Attacks World's Largest Oil Processing Facility. And do stay tuned. We'll be writing more about this and Iran's activities in the region. Watch thetrumpet.com. And Brent, thanks so much for your time.
No problem.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
Zimbabwe's long-lasting dictator Robert Mugabe died earlier this month at the age of 95 after being deposed in a coup 2 years ago. He leaves behind a complicated legacy, as we will hear in this report from Anthony Chibadadwe.
Imagine if the United States had a different first president. Imagine if the central figure of the revolution, the man who vigorously protested against the exclusion of locals from governance, the man who fought British forces, the man whose fellow general said was first in war and first in peace, was not George Washington, but Robert Mugabe.
We had free and fair elections, and the result was what you now know.
At his inauguration as president of the new nation, Mugabe would have strongly advocated peace. He would have said, "Surely this is now the time to beat our swords into plowshares, so we can attend to the problems of developing our economy and our society. Only a government that subjects itself to the rule of law has any moral right to demand of its citizens obedience to the rule of law. I urge you, whether you are black or white, to join me in a new pledge to forget our grim past, forgive others, and forget. Join hands in a new amity, and together trample upon racism, tribalism, and regionalism, and work hard to reconstruct and rehabilitate our society as we invigorate our economic machinery." The nation would have started with high ideals, with hope for the future, with the moral mandate for the leaders to be subject to the laws, just as the citizens were subject to the laws. But what would actually have happened to early Americans would have been much different. What would have actually happened to the early Americans would have been closer to what happened to the early Zimbabweans. During the nation's infancy, its first president would have trampled the rule of law. Just 4 years after signing the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution, the president would have used his power and his supporters to commit violence against his political opponents. Over a period of 5 years, he would have authorized the massacre of more than 20,000 people. Following that genocide, the president would have then led a constitutional convention, changed the constitution to dramatically increase his executive powers, and turn his young nation into a one-party state. There would have been no President John Adams, no President Thomas Jefferson, no President James Madison. The first president would not have been content with just 2 terms in office. In spite of failing health, and through the use of sham elections, he would have extended his rule to 7 terms, spanning a period of 37 years. If Robert Mugabe were America's first president, And if he had ruled in America for as long as he did in Zimbabwe, America as we know it simply wouldn't exist. This is what American historian Carol Burkin once said about George Washington.
Washington understood very clearly that everything he did as the first president of the United States would be watched by nations abroad and by people at home and would set a precedent.
Historians say that the main precedent that he set was that he left office after two terms. According to William M. Fowler, Jr., that actually was Washington's finest moment. Zimbabwe's first head of government set a different precedent. His reign began in 1980 and ended in November 2017 when one of his own organized a coup d'etat against him. His successor, President Emmerson Mnangagwa, appears determined to retain power for as long as possible and by any means he deems necessary. Mugabe died on September 6th at age 95, leaving behind a legacy many have described as complicated. Following independence from Britain in 1980, white minority rule was replaced by black majority rule, but whites retained ownership of nearly three-quarters of the agricultural land in the country, and that's an imbalance that was supposed to be resolved later, but never was. Instead, as Mugabe faced the biggest political challenges of his career in the late 1990s, he used race and land reform as weapons to gain grassroots support. But those weapons destroyed significant segments of society and the economy. The West imposed sanctions on Zimbabwe, investors fled, would-be foreign investors turned away, inflation rose astronomically, severe shortages of basic commodities, including cash, plagued the country, and racial tensions increased. Mugabe preached peace, but he allegedly authorized the slaughter of thousands of his political opponents. His leadership began with exhortations for racial unity, but it ended with vitriolic statements like, "The only white man you can trust is a dead white man," and "Our party must continue to strike fear in the heart of the white man, our real enemy." Even with 7 academic degrees, Mugabe couldn't figure out how to solve the multiple problems that bedeviled his country. He received 14 honorary degrees, but 3 of them were later revoked. He was knighted by Queen Elizabeth II in 1994, long after some of his worst atrocities had been publicized, but he was stripped of that honor in 2008. He championed African solutions for African problems, but he died in a hospital in Singapore because Zimbabwe would not have provided high-quality health services. When Mugabe died, many world leaders praised him for what they call his Pan-Africanism and his opposition to colonialism. But Mugabe's Pan-Africanism often seemed like a mere expression of anti-Anglo-Americanism. His opposition to colonialism was more of an opposition to what is often called neocolonialism. What Mugabe's supporters seem to ignore are the facts and the fruits of Mugabe's rule. Mugabe was not what many people call a good guy who turned bad. The narrative ignores both the evil he perpetuated during the early years and the good that he achieved even in his twilight years. One Zimbabwean lawyer and human rights activist said that, in truth, Mugabe the educator, Mugabe the freedom fighter, and Mugabe the dictator were intermingled throughout his life. The real problem with Robert Mugabe actually transcends Robert Mugabe himself. Hopewell Chingono, a Zimbabwean journalist and Harvard University Nieman Fellow, astutely noted the following, quote, "What you are up against is a system, not an individual. Individuals simply give identity to what is otherwise a system underpinned by corruption, nepotism, and gross incompetence. Robert Mugabe was not his political party, and his political party was not Robert Mugabe." Later on, he wrote, "My challenge to those analysts who are knowledgeable is to explain to us what the system is, who is the system, and how does it work. The Bible explains who the system is and how it actually works. The Bible reveals that an evil spirit influences this world. 2 Corinthians 4 verse 4 refers to it as the God of this world, that is, the God of this present age of mankind's existence. Through his invisible, though evident influence, he deceives the whole world. But thankfully, the true God would not allow this to continue indefinitely, as the Bible says in Revelation 12 verse 9 through 12. A time is soon coming when he will intervene in the affairs of mankind in a dramatic way. But he has reserved the prerogative to occasionally intervene in our affairs, even before that future time comes. He wants people to know that he rules in the kingdom of men and gives it to whomsoever he will, and sets up over it the basest of men, as it says in Daniel 4 verse 17. In Romans, God says that the powers that be are ordained of God. In the United States and Britain in Prophecy, Herbert W. Armstrong explained why God allows someone like Robert Mugabe to rule one nation and someone like George Washington to rule another. When God's dramatic intervention finally comes, this world will be governed by the righteous leadership of Jesus Christ. That's exciting to even think about, especially in contrast to the system of men's governments today.
Thank you very much, Anthony. So you were born in Zimbabwe, 1985. Mugabe had been in power for 5 years, and he was the only ruler you ever knew until you moved out of the country. Is that right?
Yes.
So maybe you could just talk a bit about your personal experience living under his rule, and maybe just a little bit about, say, reading the speech of what he promised, and just the promise of what his rule offered versus the reality.
President Mugabe, when he came to power, he was preaching reconciliation, and it seems like that probably surprised a lot of people. It was a pleasant surprise to a lot of people, because they thought that he was going to pay retribution. But he was preaching reconciliation. He even had a lot of people from the previous white government continue on in his own government. So that was very positive, and I think that it impacted the whole nation in a positive way. So I'd probably say that for the average Zimbabwean, everything was all good, and most people were not as invested into politics because life was good. But things changed over time when Mugabe's socialist policies started taking on, when the nation started feeling the effects of his policies. And of course, those policies have economic ramifications. So as the economy started tanking a lot more, particularly in the late 90s, a lot more people were getting more involved in politics, and a lot more people were a lot more informed about Robert Mugabe's rule, which was devastating to the country. Most people are very aware of the hyperinflation in Zimbabwe, printing currencies and having these dollar bills that would go up to $1 million bills. And after a while of using such currency, the government would decide to slash six zeros from that currency, so $1 million becomes a dollar bill, and then they continue, but then inflation would catch up with them and they have to redo the whole process. I think they did that maybe three or four times, where they're just slashing zeros. So it was almost unbelievable, but I believe it because I experienced it.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much for that. We've been talking with trumpet writer Anthony Chibodwe about the death of Robert Mugabe, Zimbabwe's longtime dictator. He died earlier this month at the age of 95. Anthony has an article about this on thetrumpet.com. What if George Washington was Robert Mugabe? You can read it there on the website. Thanks so much for your time, Anthony.
Good to be here.
It's time for today's last word.
Let's assume you don't consider yourself a finished product. You want to become a better person, kinder, healthier, smarter, more productive, more outgoing, more successful. Well, to do that, consider this bit of simple, potent advice from a highly credible source, the Bible. It's in 2 Timothy 2 and verse 3, and it says, "Endure hardness as a good soldier of Jesus Christ." There is hardness that benefits you. We naturally tend to snuggle up in our comfort zones, but in order to grow, we need the challenges and afflictions that life presents. We have to endure difficulty, even embrace it. Now, God knows this. Anciently, with the nation of Israel, he didn't shower these people with comfort and ease. He afflicted them. Moses told them, "And you shall remember all the way which the Eternal your God led you these 40 years in the wilderness to humble you and to prove you to know what was in your heart." Challenges reveal your heart. They teach you about yourself. They expose your weaknesses. They show you where you need to be stronger. The devil wants to entrap us in materialism and comforts. And if we give in and grow too comfortable, we tend to become afraid of discomfort to the point where we'll do anything to avoid it. We shy away from things that might hurt, even good, noble things like hard work, sacrificing for your family, standing up to peer pressure. If your goal is to remain comfortable at all costs, you will never do those things. Our industrial age has eliminated many of the challenges that were built into the human experience for millennia. So it's no surprise that we also have epidemic obesity, bad health, people glutted on entertainment, people unwilling to work. There was a recent poll that revealed that 20% of U.S. households have nobody working. Now, laziness, stagnation, these things tend to feed on themselves and destroy character. Everything that helps you grow is uncomfortable. Everything. Learning something new, meeting people, eating healthier, exercise, building a new habit, changing your routine to introduce something that's good for you. These things are all hard. Your mind and body want to resist. That's what makes it a fight, and that's why it works. These things break you out of complacency and lead to growth. They make you better. They make you stronger. And when you live at the edges of your comfort zone, that zone expands.
The great men of the Bible, the great men and women of the Bible understood this. That's why Paul was willing to endure terrible adversity with a positive attitude. He said, "We glory in tribulations, knowing that tribulation works patience." And he said, "I take pleasure in infirmities. I take pleasure in infirmities, in reproaches, in necessities, in persecutions, in distresses for Christ's sake." Paul didn't just endure hardness. He learned to embrace it. And you see the same message in the writings of the Apostle Peter and the Apostle James. Recognizing the benefits that you gain from challenges enables you to smile through trial. When that hard thing comes, you can do what comes naturally. You can whine, moan, complain, lose your cool, hit the snooze button, or you can embrace hardness. Don't think negatively about how much that physical workout or that spiritual trial hurts. Think about the thrill of the challenge. Focus on the fact that you can do more now than you could last month or last year. You could never grow if life were always easy. In order to keep growing, you must get comfortable with being uncomfortable. What do you fear? Well, don't turn from it. Tackle it. And as in exercise, so in life. There's a difference between good pain and bad pain. Bad pain results from mistakes and causes injury. Instead of avoiding all pain, learn the difference and avoid only bad pain. Embrace good pain and the gains it brings. In the last letter he wrote, 2 Timothy, Paul wrote this: endure afflictions. That's what he had done. He had done that through his whole life. He wrote, "I have fought a good fight. I have finished my course. I have kept the faith." Paul described his Christian life as a fight. He didn't say, "I've lived a good life." He said, "I have fought a good fight." Physically, mentally, emotionally, spiritually, you are capable of far more than you think. Let God lead you in a life of growing, overcoming, conquering, and do it with a smile on your face.
I'm Joel Hilliker, and that will do it for today's Trumpet Hour. You can send me any thoughts on today's program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to my guests, Brent Noctegal and Anthony Chibaterwe. Thanks to Jesse Hester and Josh Sloan for engineering and production. And I'll leave you with this thought from Wilfred McClay: love is the foundation of the wisest criticism, and criticism is the essential partner of an honest and enduring love. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.